Hey folks, Denise Howell here, and you're about to listen to what is bound to go down as one of my favorite episodes of This Week in Law ever. We've got monkey selfie law with the Naruto versus Slater case having been argued this week before the Ninth Circuit. Can a monkey own a copyright? Can an AI own a copyright? How do you serve a monkey? What's a monkey truther? We'll go into all of that and more. We've got Gabriella Ziccarelli, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis joining me. And Gabby is also an expert on emoji law. Why are your threatening emojis showing up as an alien? We'll try and answer that question, as well as what happens when your bank receives a bag of money emoji from you. Will it respond in kind? We hope so, but we'll tell you more next on this episode of This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Matt Curtis, and Mike Keyes, episode 393, recorded July 14th, 2017. Eggplant emoji, Parmigiana or pernicious? Hi, folks, it's Denise Howell here, and you're joining us for This Week in Law, which may be the perfect storm of topics this week for our show. We are just so excited to bring you this show this week because so many wonderful things have been happening that we're dying to discuss. And we have an incredible guest joining us for a cutting edge area of the law that she has been paying attention to, which has to do with emojis. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the show and introduce to you Gabriella Ziccarelli. Hello, Gabby.
Hi, so good to be here.
Great to see you. Wonderful to have you here. Gabby is a practicing attorney in Washington, D.C., where she practices technology and IP law with Blank Rome LLP. She's also a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry and a graduate of the Santa Clara School of Law, where she studied with Professor Goldman, who's been on our show for many, many episodes, Never Not Awesome on Twill with Professor Goldman on. And she has authored a 57-page in-depth survey with him on the law of emojis. So really wonderful to get the chance to talk with you this week, Gabby.
So excited. And just quickly, yeah, I was so fortunate to get to work with Eric. Is outstanding, and actually just provided notes on his. Most of the work was done by him, but it's a great piece, and I encourage you all to read it.
He's so generous, Gabby, that he always, in discussing this with me, has highlighted the critical role that you played in generating this article. So I just assumed you were the co-author, but you're right. You don't have a byline. He does.
No, but it's an exciting area of law, and I'm so pumped to talk with you all about it today.
We're excited to talk with you too. And Matt and Mike are both here. Matt Curtis, my co-host, is a law student at Notre Dame, interning in Washington, D.C. this summer. Hello, Matt.
Hi, good to see you guys again. I'm going to give a quick shout out to my dad. It's his birthday. So hi, Dad. And hello, everyone else.
Yay. Happy birthday, Matt's happy dad. Birth. What's your dad's name?
John.
John Curtis, have a wonderful day. Am I allowed to ask how old that is?
You may be allowed to ask. I will be embarrassed not to actually know the answer. I think it's a few. So, Victor, if you can edit that part out.
That's hysterical. All right. And also here is Mike Keyes, a partner with the Dorsey firm in Seattle, Washington, and my other wonderful co-host here on This Week in Law. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be here with all of you today.
Great to see you, too. You know, I forgot to put in the rundown, Mike, but maybe if we have time later on, we should discuss that another shoe has dropped in the Dr. Seuss mashup case. So perhaps at the end we'll get to that. But we have a lot to get to. Yes, we have a lot to get to before then. And we're going to start with a little case that has actually spawned a whole feature on our show, one of our favorite pieces of litigation of all time, and I'm sure one of yours too, the monkey selfie case. Naruto versus Slater, the formal name of this case, was argued before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal in San Francisco this Wednesday. And much hilarity ensued. It was the end of the morning docket. It was a case where many, many questions were asked to the PETA lawyers that seemed to indicate perhaps that the Ninth Circuit was leaning toward the direction the Copyright Office has gone. The Copyright Office has explicitly said that animals cannot hold copyrights, in its esteemed opinion. The Copyright Office's opinion, though, is not binding necessarily on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or on Congress or any other law-making body. It's just how the Copyright Office has said it's going to treat the copyright analysis for animals. So for a little background on people who may not have been following this case that closely, several years ago, a photographer named David Slater was in Indonesia, and he was photographing some macaques. And I'm not sure how his camera equipment got left where the macaques could pick it up, but one of them did and snapped the now famous photo that, if you're watching our video, you are seeing of the grinning macaque Naruto. Now, I'm going to put an asterisk when I say that this is a photograph of Naruto, because that is not necessarily something that we know for sure. And that's actually possibly an issue in the case. So we'll bookmark that and come back to it in a moment. In any event, a monkey, a primate for sure, a macaque, took the photo that you were looking at. We're not sure if it was Naruto. And the photograph wound up on Wikimedia Commons, under the theory, per Wikimedia Commons, that a primate cannot hold the copyright to a photo that it took. And if the primate doesn't hold the copyright, the primate as photographer is the only person that could hold the copyright. So David Slater does not, the person who owned the camera equipment. And so, ergo, the photo must be in the public domain. David Slater didn't agree with that and went on to publish a book himself and to collaborate with self-publishing platform Blurb. I don't know if you've used Blurb before. I certainly have. It's somewhere where you can go and upload your photos and format them into a nice little book. And that's what David Slater did. So there is a book available on Blurb to this day that is a collection of David Slater's photographs of animals. The macaque is on the cover. It's called Wildlife Personalities. It features various other animals that he has photographed on the inside. So, at least one of which, there is another monkey in here that has arms out in front of it. That may have taken that one right there on the left, if you're watching the video, that may have taken the selfie of itself. I don't know if the other macaque there featured. We can't tell if that's a photo that was taken by the monkey itself or by David Slater. But in any event, he has this nice collection of photos that he and Blurb are profiting from if anybody buys this book from the Blurb site. Enter PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, who have come in and sued over this book on behalf of and as what's called a next friend of the animal who they claim is Naruto, who took the photograph that went viral and became famous. So this litigation has been pending for a while. We've been chuckling at it for a while, and it was just argued before the Ninth Circuit. And within a couple, 3 months, we will have their decision on whether PETA can sue in the place of the animal to assert what it claims are the animal's copyrights. Some interesting notes from the oral argument. The issue of which macaque it is did come up. The panel was grilling the PETA lawyer on whether they would have standing to sue on behalf of an animal that they have not named, because apparently one of the scientists who had worked with these macaques and was involved in working with PETA in the litigation for a while, but had a falling out with them, claims to know, and would be the kind of person who would know, that the person, one of the photos is not actually of Naruto. And that PETA may have named the wrong animal, maybe purporting to represent the wrong animal. Hence was born, as Sarah Jong calls it, the monkey truther movement. People trying to get to the bottom of which monkey is actually in the photograph. So we had that going on at the oral argument. There was also a lovely exchange about... And let me see if I can actually find it here and read you some of the text from the argument. Sarah Jong watched it live and wrote it up for Motherboard. The statute, the blurb attorney at one point pointed out that the statute refers to sending out written notice of a copyright lawsuit to anyone else who has or claims an interest in the same copyright. So she says it makes no sense to allow a monkey to enforce a copyright suit. But if you're going to do that, it's equally absurd to deny a monkey written notice of a right to intervene in a lawsuit. And then one of the judges interrupted and said, well, Naruto wouldn't need written notice. Maybe the other macaque monkeys in Indonesia would, at which point the courtroom burst into laughter, as we all can too, pondering the notion of how perhaps one would give notice to a macaque. Maybe it would have to be done in emoji form, Gabby.
Maybe the monkey see, monkey do not hear.
Yes. And then a gavel and the scales of justice.
The camera, the photo emoji, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So that all happened this week, and we are just so thrilled. Sarah and others seem to think that PETA does not have a shot here. But rather than just, you know, say that and say, as the Copyright Office did, that animals can't hold copyrights and this is a ridiculous case and we must move on. I think this case goes further than that, right? It's what has rights and what rights do things have that are not human? And I think that starts to become a really interesting question when we start to consider works created by AI, which are becoming more and more common. Mike, now that we've sort of put this all on the table for people, what are your impressions?
Boy, where do I begin?
Yes.
You know, I have so many thoughts on this case. I will say that I was listening to the oral argument on YouTube and found it to be quite amusing. I particularly liked David Slater's counsel opening line of argument was something like, monkey see, monkey sue should not be the law in the Ninth Circuit. you know, we've talked about this before. I think the result is obvious. I'm not really making a wild prediction here that the Ninth Circuit is most likely going to at least affirm the decision. There's an open issue, I think, as to whether the defendants are entitled to attorney's fees under Section 505, and Slater's attorney asked for this case to be remanded, at least for that determination, as far as the amount was concerned. So, I mean, look, under the copyright statute, as we've discussed before, there's absolutely no indication that Congress ever thought that a monkey or an animal or a non-human could be an author for purposes of copyright law. I think the result is going to be obvious here. I would be beyond stunned if this case goes any further than it's gone thus far. But to your point, Denise, I think what really is the interesting issue here, and this is something that's ultimately going to have to be resolved at the congressional level as opposed to through the judiciary, is what do we do with works of authorship that are clearly being created by artificial intelligence? Paintings, music, all of that would clearly satisfy the requirement for originality and creativity when it comes to a work of authorship under the Copyright Act. And I'm just not certain, I'm not convinced that there's an answer. I think as the statute reads right now, those works wouldn't be subject to copyright protection because they're not authored by a human being. But I think this is ultimately going to have to be an issue that's addressed. As silly as this PETA case is, in my opinion, it does kind of forecast or look forward to this other issue that is much more meaningful and much more important, which is, you know, can artificial beings that are created by humans create works of authorship? And I think the answer's got to be yes, and that's going to have to be addressed by Congress in some form or fashion. So those are just some of my thoughts.
Right. And in other countries, works created by computer, whether artificially intelligent or not, I guess self-directed at least would be the criteria here. They're not being considered created by a human. They're being considered created by a computer. In the UK and in other countries like Ireland and New Zealand, those works do have copyright, but it belongs to the person who made the arrangements to have that creative work made. So that's one approach. And then On the other extreme, there are countries like Spain and Germany that specifically say that only works created by a human can be subject to copyright protection. So, you know, here in the U.S., we seem to be straddling the fence on what we think AI created works, where we think they fall on that protection spectrum. And, you know, PETA does make the point, or it tries to, this was argued back at the district court in 2016, that, you know, the point that you raise, Mike, is that when the Copyright Act was written, and even going back to when, you know, the Constitution was written, which is the basis for the Copyright Act, that nobody involved in that process was thinking about copyrights for anything other than humans. But PETA is casting this as, okay, well, the law evolves and things have changed since we first established the principles that now are the law of our land. For example, they make the point that the judges just can't assume that persons under the Copyright Act have to mean human beings, because, you know, at one point or another, marriage was only between a man and a woman, and we've evolved away from that approach as far as the law is concerned. And PETA argues that actually giving the animal rights here, regardless of whether they can establish they have the right animal. That, by the way, is one possible outcome here, is the court just sort of punts and says, you haven't established that, you know, the animal you've sued on behalf of is the animal in the photo. And until you do that, you know, go away and come back when you've got that T crossed. So that would be one way to not reach the merits here. But in reaching the merits, PETA has said that if the court does grant PETA the ability to act on behalf of these animals, that it's a step forward, acknowledging that things have changed, much like, you know, what is marriage? They have, here's Sarah Zhang's characterization. She writes, Speaking of PETA's attorney, he also said at the time that Naruto's supposed inability to own a copyright was analogous to an enslaved African American's inability to own a patent prior to the adoption of the 14th Amendment. Whether these analogies make a convincing case for animal rights or are actually wildly offensive, I will leave as an exercise to the reader. So there is, if we're going to be establishing that creative works by a computer are protectable and maybe ultimately that a computer has some sort of awareness and agency and a right to some sort of personhood status, then doesn't it seem unfair that animals aren't at least in the running for that kind of consideration? What do you think, Matt?
I don't think it's about fairness. I think that you have to think about like what is the purpose of our laws designed for, and you know the slave issue is something that like the laws were designed not to protect slaves, and therefore they didn't have standing to sue. And that was a terrible time in our history, and that's something we've moved on from. But ultimately, like, you know, the philosophical reason that we moved on from that was because slaves were people, and we acknowledged that. I don't think that we're ever going to get to a time where an animal is a person or has the same dignity as a person. And I'm not sure that we'll ever get that way with computers. I think that there's other ways to go about getting copyrights for this as an extension of a person who owns a computer, of an extension of someone who wrote the computer code that eventually wrote the computer code. And it, that kind of sounds like what the other countries are actually doing. That they're not independently giving a computer the right to own it. They're giving a person who owns the computer who wrote the code the copyright ownership, mm-hmm. which I think is, you know, just as a philosophical reason, you can look at the world and see, and I'm pretty sure this is how PETA looks at the world, that organic life is the same and humans aren't better or any way different. I don't think that's the approach that the law takes, and I don't think that that's like a very effective way for human flourishing for the law to take.
Right. So, Gabby, let's assume for a moment that Sarah and other commentators are right, that the Ninth Circuit isn't going to give PETA the right to assert copyrights on behalf of the subject of the photo here, mm-hmm. assuming they've got the right subject. Yeah. Hashtag monkey truthers. Let's assume they're right. Should that necessarily mean that David Slater then has the copyright or doesn't have the copyright? Maybe what our law should do is not take the approach that the Copyright Office has taken and that Wikimedia Commons took, that these would necessarily be public domain because no one could own the copyright. But maybe we should follow that UK approach with regard to things created by machines and say, okay, the photographer did not take the photo, but the fact that the photographer had the camera there, made the camera available to the animal who took the photo, means the photographer gets the copyright. What do you think about that?
It's a good question. And, you know, that would be the sensible approach here. I mean, mm-hmm. to make a funny analogy, think about all of the young kids. I'm sure you've seen this on your friend's Facebook page or Instagram. Their child accidentally takes a selfie and they post it. Does the baby own it? Is the parent infringing by posting their child's picture? I mean, as silly as that sounds, it's a similar analogy of where we're going here. And so, you know, arguably, yeah, the parent can, of course, post that picture of their kid or if someone were to use that. So in this situation with the monkey, you know, maybe we make it easier on those situations for those particular. I mean, the photographer is actually, I saw an article today complaining he's broke after this lawsuit. I mean, he was just doing his job and wanted to mm-hmm. share his experiences, and now he's paying legal fees. And so, you know, maybe the solution is what you're suggesting, yeah. giving the right to the photographer. But, you know, also thinking about this, I'm going to take a step back and I read a piece about how, okay, the corporation, for example, is not a person per se, and there's the back and forth with the Supreme Court making that decision. And, you know, maybe this was in the context of his work, and it was, you know, his camera that he used. So maybe there's an argument where in that unique situation where a non-human is involved, if it is your materials that were used, so your phone, your camera, whatever it was, in the course of your work, maybe, you know, you would retain that copyright. And I think we're in this strange gray area where no matter how we come out with regard to can a monkey have these copyright rights, we have to look back to standing too. I was taking a look at some of the circuit law, and you had mentioned the issue of notice. And a lot of circuits have come out on strictly the issue of copyright ownership, that the claim for contesting copyright ownership accrues when the claimant has expressed notice that someone else is claiming ownership. And so I know there was the joke back and forth, but this is truly the law. Whether you're a monkey or a person, you know, you need to have received an express notice. So, I mean, I doubt the photographer sent a letter, like they said, to, you know, Naruto, hey, I think this is mine. You know, simply publishing it's more of an implied notice. And so, you know, that begs the question. We have these laws. There's an expectation that you're going to check everything off so you truly have a claim accruing. And, you know, PETA may have brought it prematurely and to guise it as copyright infringement versus, hey, we're just talking about copyright ownership here. Because in a traditional copyright infringement case, usually ownership is pretty clear and you move into the infringement factor. So I think, you know, regardless of if you're a machine or an animal or a person, we have rules of law and you shouldn't be wasting the court's resources unless you've met those requirements for standing.
Right. Hey, Mike, do you by any chance know the answer to the issue that's sort of floating around here? Obviously, human children qualify as humans. So they at least meet that. Yeah, some. let's not go there.
There's a question of fact there.
That's a question of fact. I assume that they have that the way that their intellectual property rights are treated is they have some under the law.
They do. You mean the heirs of an author?
No, I mean children as artists.
Oh, you mean an independent right? Like if they're a minor, do you own the copyright as opposed to your parents?
Yes.
You know, that's a good question. I assume that a minor author is still considered the author for purposes of copyright protection, but I don't know the answer. Of course, when it comes to descendancy and having the rights in children have rights to works that were created by their parents. Under the statute that's provided for, you get a life of the author plus 75 years, which there's successive generations that benefit from this, which raises the issue as to whether, you know, the grandson or granddaughter of Naruto, you know, if they would be able to exploit these copyrights, should he be awarded ownership. You know, so you've got all sorts of interesting succession issues. The other thing that, you know, not to heap on absurdity after absurdity here, but under the Act, of course, an author, when you sue for infringement, you have the right to elect to receive either statutory damages or actual damages as part of the remedy. And, you know, how would Naruto go about signaling his intent when it comes to either statutory damages or actual damages? You know, so you've got all sorts of problems with an animal being an author under the statute that clearly you wouldn't there are just, you know, big swaths of the statute that wouldn't be applicable because you wouldn't be able to implement them. So
right.
I went off on a tangent there. I'm not sure that was even remotely related to the question that you asked me, Denise.
Yeah, no, that's okay. It's an interesting tangent. And I guess whether you're a minor and you can have, you know, own copyrights in something, have a patent in something, register a trademark would all depend on, because you can't contract. You're not legally capable of forming an enforceable contract. So we know that under U.S. law. But if you can own property, I think that might weigh in. Matt, you're in law school. Do you know?
Whether an animal can own property?
No.
Or whether a child can own property?
Human child.
A human child can own property. So one of the things that some people were doing to get around banking regulations for insider trading was that they were actually having their children trade on their accounts, and it was a big problem a couple of years ago. So certainly, you know, children own assets. Now the question of is can they sue for them in court? And then I think that PETA is correct. If this was a child, that they would bring it as a parental unit. But yeah, I mean, as a former child, I had assets, I had things that I owned, So I can speak from experience.
Right. And it's worth mentioning that rule that if you are a child with rights that need to be enforced somehow, there's this next friend doctrine that allows your parents or grandparents to do it for you. That's the rule that PETA was using here. And the court was skeptical too, whether, it should apply in this situation, because we're not talking about human children. We're talking about macaques.
So. Yeah. And I think that, the absurdity is that, the rule of capture, the basic English common law rule of capture is if they would killed the animal or they had captured the animal would have been their property. And that's something you can't say about a person at all. So I think that, Mike followed PETA on a tangent here.
All right. Well, we'll go around since this is just such a fun story and we could talk about it the whole show, but we won't. We have other fun things to talk about. I'll just go around once and if anybody has any concluding musings about animals, AI, copyrights, or serving a monkey, now would be the time. Mike, you go first.
Oh, boy. My prediction, as I said, I think this will be a unanimous decision by the panel. I think the case is likely going to be remanded for a determination as to whether attorney's fees are appropriate and warranted under the circumstances.
All right. Gabby?
I'd say, keep an eye out. This is our first taste of what we're going to do with regard to, artificial intelligence and technology, depending on what angle we take here in America. One thing I'm going to leave the viewers with is, how are we going to calculate, let's say we give the robots the copyright and we do age plus 70, robots could live forever. So how are we going to adjust? So it's worth thinking about.
Matt?
I think this was bring your kid to work day for a judge. just a monkey can't have copyright.
And my final thought is one thing that the panel hammered on quite a bit at oral argument is, okay, let's assume for a moment, PETA, that you're right, that you have standing to bring this lawsuit, that you're authorized to act on this animal's behalf, that you've got the right animal. What's the harm? How can a monkey's copyright be infringed? And if it is infringed, are we entitled to do anything here if there's no harm to the monkey? The monkey could care less about this. The monkey is not capable of suffering financial harm. The monkey is happily munching whatever monkeys munch in Indonesia somewhere. to which PETA may reply, well, if there are rights here, then we can do good things on the monkey's behalf with those rights for it and other monkeys similarly situated. But I think this case, in addition to all the other fun things it gives us to talk about, it also gives us a chance to talk about the fact that if there is no actual damage or harm to the rights holder, does a copyright case go anywhere? And that seems to have been on the panel's mind as well. So we're going to move on to somebody else who claims to have been harmed. This time, different people by different Kardashians. This is an issue that I put in the rundown because we've talked a lot this year about the Star Athletica case that was decided by the Supreme Court in May, right, Mike?
It was.
I think it was May? Yeah.
Recently, within the last few months.
Spring-ish. And as a reminder to folks who may not have listened to those episodes or been paying attention to various things coming up in the Supreme Court, the Star Athletica case was a dispute between a couple of cheerleading uniform manufacturers over whether various stripes and chevrons and other elements of the cheerleading uniforms were copyrightable. And if so, could one sue the other for infringement of their designs? And fashion copyright infringement cases in the U.S. Tend to be hard to succeed on. Most of the elements that are alleged in those contexts aren't things that our law recognizes as something you can enforce an infringement action about. But the Supreme Court sort of changed course on that for the fashion industry in this recent case, finding that various decorative elements of a fashion design could be copyrightable and you could sue. So with that background, I think it's really interesting to consider the kinds of cases, and they don't always have to involve Kardashians, but they are becoming more and more common. And as Gabby was pointing out before the show, they might become more and more common the more that all of us are using social media and can put these kinds of things out there and be alerted to these kinds of things because of the way that people are connected. So there is an op-ed by Shamara Lawrence at Teen Vogue that states two cases of independent African-American designers who went on social media and said that in one case, Khloe Kardashian had taken one of her designs and incorporated it into Khloe's line. And that in another case, that Kylie Jenner had done something similar with a designer, a brand called Plugged NYC. So in the, let's see, Khloe's line is called Great American, I think. In that instance, they had sort of a mesh top with spangles on it. Khloe Kardashian's legal team actually, when the designer took to social media and posted some side-by-side photos, here's what I made, here's what's in Great American. Oh, and by the way, I have the receipts from Khloe Kardashian's people buying these pieces from my line. And then, you know, lo and behold, later on, they come out with something that looks a whole lot like mine. Khloe Kardashian's legal team sent a cease and desist letter and said their designs were inspired by things worn by Cher, et cetera. And I'm not sure how Kylie Kardashian responded, but the design elements in question here seem to be, you know, sort of a mesh spangled top with sequiny spangles all over strategic areas of the top. And then in the Kylie Jenner case, pieces made from brightly colored camo prints are at issue. And it seems to be the shape of the pieces more than the use of a camo print that seems to be at issue here. So Mike, you wrote up, I remember the Star Athletica case at the time. Mm-hmm. Do you think under that precedent, either of these two designers, if they wanted to, could take the Kardashians to court?
Well, it's an interesting question. So I think you gave a really good synopsis of what the court ultimately held. So what, just to drill down a little bit further, what the court held in Star Athletica is, to the extent that you've got a utilitarian item, in that case it was a cheerleading outfit, and that there are graphical or sculptural components that can be imagined separately from that particular useful article, and they can exist independently of it, then you can claim copyright protection with respect to those particular elements. Now, if you look at there's two different designs that I'm looking. I'm looking at the camo design here, and I'm looking at the one on the right that has the kind of the sequiny looking design here. As you pointed out, Denise, the sequins are strategically placed on the garment to cover a part of the women's body. I think there would be a fairly compelling argument that, well, that's functional in nature because it's actually that particular part of the design is covering and intended to cover a part of a woman's body, and therefore it would be functional. It wouldn't be subject to copyright protection at all. But to the extent you could get past the functionality argument, then the question is, well, does this particular particular design, can it exist independently of the garment itself? Is there sufficient originality or creativity with respect to this design? And I think with respect to the sequin one, I don't know. I think that's going to be a tough sell. I'm not sure that there's sufficient originality or creativity here that would entitle copyright protection. Now, albeit the standard for copyright protection is low, exceedingly low in some circumstances, I'm not sure that it gets there. The other one where it is, I'm not sure if that's, which is that Kylie there, the one that's wearing the camo?
Yep.
So Kylie, that to me is less of a Star Athletica issue. Fabric designs themselves, the patterns, have always been protectable, even before Star Athletica. Star Athletica dealt with that unique question in the context of cheerleading uniforms. But this is a pattern here. It's a camo pattern. I'm not so certain that it's ultimately going to be protectable as a work of authorship, but it seems to me that's probably a closer call. There's various ways that you could put together a camo pattern that arguably would involve a dash of creativity. This particular design, this pattern design, is not functional like the other one, so I think it's probably a closer call.
It's a combination that's being complained about here, not just the use of camo, a camo print or an interestingly colored camo print, but also the shape of the garment, the combination of the pieces involved, etc. There's also a component here of the complaint that the Kardashians get a lot, and that is that it's sort of this cultural appropriation argument. That they are, it's important to the person who wrote this article that the two lesser known designers who are complaining here are African American. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's sort of bad enough that in the fashion industry people rip each other off, but worse when the context is very well known Caucasian women with strong brand recognition, buying things from. And in both cases, the designers say they have proof that the Kardashians and Jenners bought things from their line and then shortly thereafter came out with things that resembled the things that they bought. So I'm kind of interested in this. There's a lot of texture to this, and I'm wondering, Gabby, whether you think that any of these kinds of concerns that are being raised could alter our copyright law at all, such that maybe there would be more protection against being the article and the author here of the op-ed uses the term knockoff, and I think that's probably going a bit far for what we're talking about here. But as far as giving protection from a well-known brand using the designs of a lesser known brand or from a culturally advantaged situation using the designs of someone less so. What do you think about that?
It's tough because the way our intellectual property system has been constructed, you know, there's only so much that copyright will cover. And in looking at Kylie's example, you know, how much of that part with the styling, is it functional? You know, are we crossing over into other intellectual property territory? So I think we're going to have to be mindful, if copyright law is to evolve, that we're not crossing into functionality and utility that a patent would cover, or a design patent, or, you know, perhaps it's the way that a particular garment is made. So let's say we have a young entrepreneur who's making a dynamic type of workout pants, that the way they're made, you know, the wicking is good, and, you know, there's some sort of functionality to it as well. We want to make sure that all of our IP kind of touches each other in a way that there's full coverage. That if a Kardashian were to purchase that and almost reverse engineer it, you know, obviously patent law might come into play. But I think it's really going to depend on the garment, on, like you mentioned, it's tough in the fashion industry. We see fast fashion is always knocking off high fashion. We see plenty of lawsuits, not even just with the small entrepreneur, but we see Forever 21 is constantly in litigation, H&M. For years, you know, not in America, but abroad, there's been issues with some of the biggest fashion houses that we can think of, from, you know, Gucci and Guess going at each other with, you know, different emblems. I mean, there's a value in the reproduction. And so now that we at least have the Supreme Court case to give a little guidance about what would constitute a copyrightable portion of fashion, we can start to build off of that. And at least we can work in our creation of our, you know, the small business owners can. But I think at this point, it's just going to take time, and we're going to need more cases and more examples of what falls under Star Athletica and what doesn't, so we can really move forward. But in terms of the justice factor, it's unfair. Something that came to my attention, it's not just in fashion. There are other celebrities who maybe, if you use the term, knocking off of other small innovators on websites like Kickstarter or, you know, Indiegogo. You know, I what came to my attention before this podcast was that there Rob Gronkowski actually had put forward a Gronk ball, which is a, you know, fun little football that you can throw around with the speaker. But about 2 years ago, there was a Kickstarter campaign with two small entrepreneurs who had created the same thing and had tweeted the idea at him, hoping he would free endorse it and retweet it. So, you know, it's not just fashion. We have a ton of entrepreneurs that are now coming up, and the internet allows them to have the atmosphere to really promote their product, but it also puts them at risk. So keeping that in mind moving forward, and how intellectual property protection is going to be key as you grow your business.
Yeah, and what advice would you give, you know, the bro ball guys in this situation, or people like them who, you know, have a great idea and are Kickstartering it, or otherwise, you know, fundraising and trying to get known? Obviously, you want to have lawyers involved and do what you can to protect your IP. But if we are in this weird fashion kind of situation where it's taken, you know, as the status quo matter in the United States, that people get inspired by one another, to put it generously, what should those creative, independent people do?
It's tough, because your gut is, I made this beautiful outfit and I want to share it with the world. And especially now, fashion bloggers, the entire scene is very visual. But at the same time, you put your fantastic design online, and it's very easy via Instagram for someone to share it, to screenshot it, to repeat it. So, you know, it would depend on the business, but one piece of advice might be to your advantage. You'd still know people screenshotted it, but maybe use more of the disappearing forms of social media to give kind of a sneak peek at what you're working on. Maybe if you're a fashion designer, you do a quick Snapchat story to your followers, showing them, you know, the bedazzled portion of that, of like coming soon, this and that. There's ways to still market your brand, get it out there, but perhaps maybe you're only doing the disclosures in person versus having this electronic footprint. And it's tough, because even though it's free marketing, it's what's your risk threshold. And I think it'll depend on who the innovator is and how willing they are to take that risk.
I think that's really good advice. And it also helps address the problem that if you are sharing static photos and they're getting shared and reshared and reshared, so at some point the attribution to you is going to go away. Just the lovely design idea will be out there for anyone to look at and go, oh, I'm going to make something that's just like that. And they won't even know where that
I found it on Pinterest, or it was, you know, on ASOS.
Yes.
It'll somehow, you're right, it just loses its sense of who it actually is tied to.
Right. Matt, any thoughts on this one?
I'm blissfully ignorant of the Kardashians and high or low fashion, but there is an interesting case in Australia where Aboriginals were granted copyrights as a group. And one of the issues that they had was that individuals within the group were trying to sell, I think it was a painting or something, copies of it, and they were actually sued by the group itself. So when you're thinking about like ways to remedy cultural appropriation, like somehow having an extra layer of rights that a group would hold. So if African Americans would hold rights to whatever the fashion is, I have no idea. But it does provide a barrier to entry for individuals within the group, as well as an exclusion from people outside of the group. So I just think that is a, you know, I think that, you know, I am all for people not watching the Kardashians because of this. But – or just in general, And
I think, but, yes, you're all for people just not watching the Kardashians.
Sorry. But I think that this, you know, this is ultimately not something that can be handled by the law, in the sense that it would give groups rights over certain images or ideas.
Right. That seems like a really interesting idea. And I'm glad you brought up the Aborigine case/situation in Australia. That's fascinating. But if you were to try and do something like that in the US, I think it would be difficult. What do you think, Mike?
Yes, I would say that's probably right. Although, kind of to Gabby's point that she was mentioning about how, at least in terms of Star Athletica, how we're going to need more cases to come through and to have the law developed. I think that's a very valid point. You know, we really don't know the outer bounds of how far Star Athletica goes. There was a very recent case I wanted to mention that was just filed, the second amended complaint a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. filed by Adidas or Puma versus Forever 21, kind of the king of fast fashion. And in that suit, there's a number of items that are alleged to be infringing under Star Athletica. And one is, I think they're all shoes, the trade dress of this Creeper trade dress is what, or the Fenty trade dress that's alleged. But, you know, they're alleging specifically that a sole on a shoe in this case can exist independently as its own work of authorship, separate and apart from, I guess, the shoe itself. So that, you know, obviously invokes Star Athletica. I think they actually cite Star Athletica in the amended complaint. So we're going to start to see how far Star Athletica goes. And if it does extend to such things as soles on shoes and some of these other items that have been alleged. So stay tuned.
All right, Matt, I think you've inspired our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. It's going to be to watch or not to watch. we put these phrases in the show in case you are an attorney or other professional and you like to watch or listen to the show for professional credit in your field. If you would like some more information about that, go to wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there. And if you're an attorney in the United States, we have information and links to forms, et cetera, how you might go about applying for credit in your jurisdiction. So to watch or not to watch is our first phrase. We'll put another one in. Some places like to have you verify that you actually watched or listened rather than just writing episode 393 of This Week in Law down on a list somewhere. So we do this for that reason. And we'll put another one in at some point. Keep your pencils at the ready. But right now, we're going to talk about the law of the social web and specifically emoji law. So we have discussed at least one emoji law case on the show. It was the one, you'll have to remind me of the names of the parties involved, Gabby, but the one that involved the dispute in Israel where someone had been interested in renting an apartment but never signed a lease and then was sued and successfully sued by the landlord who claimed, hey, I got chipmunk emojis from you. That meant you were going to rent the place. and you owe me a couple of thousand dollars with the equivalent of what was a couple thousand dollars US. And the court agreed. So obviously using emojis is, by the way, do you use for the plural emoji or emojis? Because I would say you're one of the preeminent experts, so you would know.
People are split on this, actually. Robin Samire of The Atlantic wrote a great article on this, and he prefers emojis just because we are in the English language, but in other countries, emoji is the plural. So it really depends on your preference at this point. And when we get a definitive answer, I'll definitely let you know.
All right, good. So for the time being, we will accept either for purposes of this episode of This Week in Law. So we've discussed that case, and that case just sort of gives you an idea of the fact that emojis can have consequences. And I really think that as people are out there texting them to one another, emailing them to one another, slacking them to one another, that is probably not in the forefront of their minds. But it should be, because it's coming up more and more in court, isn't it, Gabby?
It is. And, you know, we have in the past seen emoticon cases. And of course, for those who don't know, emoticon usually comes from a text-based, you know, colon, parentheses, you can make a smiley face, versus an emoji, which is truly a mini little picture. And our evidentiary record is being built now in a way that, by nature of what you mentioned, that it's coming up in everything from our text messages to our Facebook messages to even at work on our Slack channels, that by nature we're going to have these being built into what we are looking at when it comes to evidence. And so we haven't had a lot of cases come up yet, but my fantastic former professor Eric Goldman has drafted essentially what is the status of the law on emoji, and you should take a look at it on SSRN, and it gives you a sense of the few cases we do have and how we are going to assess where we might go in the future as we see this in a court of law and as we see this in all kinds of type of legal issues that may come our way.
Right. So we talked about the case in Israel where someone actually, and I think that you and Professor Goldman, he wrote it up on his blog, probably feel that the court went too far there, that, you know, extrapolating some sort of contractual intent from chipmunks and other sort of positive emoji was probably reaching on the court's part, or how do you feel about that case?
I would say this, as Americans, it feels like a reach, because personally, I can't speak to what there may be some subcultural references. Maybe a chipmunk is a positive, emoji in that culture. And I don't know. And so it's a big issue that we have in emoji law, and will really come down to someday when we have a set of jurors who may come with their own cultural interpretations of an emoji, what that meant. And so it may not have been reaching. And what we do see in these cases, especially in this particular one, the Israeli judge decided on, was that it was not just the emoji, but the combination of the comments that came with it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the key here, that we're seeing it's an enhancement, or it can also be a way of negating a comment. There was a case, there was a Prince case where you may have seen the dancing, I don't know if you've spoken about it before, the dancing baby case where a mom had uploaded the video of her, you know, baby dancing to a Prince song. And one of the sidebar issues was whether or not she actually felt harmed. And they were actually going through her text messages. And granted, this was an emails, and this was an emoticon, not an emoji, but gives us a sense of what the court will do with it, to get a sense of her true intent with her commentary. So, you know, did the winky face mean she really wasn't harmed? This really wasn't a big deal. So courts are really picking this apart. And you'll want to be mindful going forward when we're looking at these cases as to whether or not, if the text doesn't tell us enough, what does the quote unquote nonverbal tell us? And, you know, there's another recent case that had come out, and they were looking again to emoji. There was a woman who had filed a lawsuit after going through an interview process, claiming that she had suffered emotional distress because one of the gentlemen who was going through the interview process with her on the employer side was being inappropriate. Well, and filing that lawsuit.
You're using the term gentleman loosely here.
I am using it very loosely, as I will segue into. So, you know, there was an exchange of text messages, certain photos, etc., an emoji. And the court decided that some of the emojis she used suggested there could be no way she was truly distressed. So taking a look at emoji that may imply flirtation or encouragement of certain behaviors. And so, you know, as much as we see them as harmless, they can be taken in the context that they're provided in a text message or an email. And I mean, this lady essentially, they said, your case is relevant. You know, we've taken the emoji to indicate your true intent. So, you know, it's worth thinking about when you send that next message, or as we learned in the Israeli case, a combination of a certain number of emoji. And we get into a very weird place now, because tech companies and our platforms are encouraging us to use emoji. And it may not be the emoji perhaps you intended. So an example I like to use is Venmo, which is a payment platform. If you want to pay your friends back for something, you know, splitting a bill or a restaurant, now you can enter in a couple words that put in ramen and the ramen emoji pops up. Or sometimes you'll put in a different word and it'll be three or four emoji that pop up. And we see this in everything from Venmo to the Apple iOS. We'll make a suggestion. My favorite example of potential danger is if you type in hi, you'll get the wavy emoji. If you type in hit or slap, you may also get the wavy emoji. Mm-hmm. And you can see where in a domestic abuse case, that could be a serious issue and actually a decent alibi. Someone could say, well, no, I typed in hi. I did not mean slap. Or I would have never suggested that I would actually, you know, hurt my significant other. So we're getting into a dangerous space that as attorneys, especially if you're litigating, it's good to wise up on not only emoji, but the technology that utilizes emoji and where there could be shortcomings and how you have to build an evidentiary record to make sure that your client is being represented adequately in a court of law.
Right. And you raised the good point that some tools, I think iOS does this. If you type the word and it suggests an emoji, I forget exactly what you have to do if you hit space or... There are times when it will replace the word with the emoji.
Correct.
And if you're not paying attention, you're sending the emoji and not the word.
Right. And that can get you into, and at the time you think, haha, yeah. Oops, my bad. And you clarify. But you know what? If you're in a court of law and let's say we're dealing with an employment dispute or wrongful termination, and there's some offensive emoji that got put in there by accident when you're really just asking someone about lunch. Maybe you want to get some eggplant parmesan, and you ended up with the eggplant emoji. You're in dangerous territory, silly as that sounds to us now. But perhaps that was an interaction, but later on you had said something that could be taken either way. And the problem here is that we can easily go to a dictionary and get a sense of what a word means. And even, you know, with slang, for example, the word that's so sick, which has evolved from meaning like that's really cool, that's dope, versus actually, you know, ill. There's always a way to kind of clarify there and we can come to a decent conclusion in a court of law. With emoji, I mean, even amongst friend groups, there are certain emojis where you almost have a secret speak amongst you that wouldn't be readily apparent to the average juror. Or there might be cultures that, like we had mentioned with the Israeli instance, but even within America where certain emoji means certain things, or even gender-based, you know, women to men. And so, you know, we have to be really mindful of this as we move forward, especially when our technology is pushing us, you know, to use these emoji. I mean, even on Twitter now, when there's a special sponsored event happening and you type in the hashtag, the emoji pops up. And so, you know, we're becoming increasingly emoji heavy. Even today, actually, it was yesterday I noticed that banking is going emoji. I was logging into my account and I was encouraged to talk to the chatbot and send the big sack of money emoji to ask for my my current amount of money in my bank account.
Wait. If you send them the big sack of money emoji, will they send you a big sack of money?
Here's hoping. I'll report back.
Because I want to switch banks.
But, you know, that is, to me, the ultimate affirmation of if corporate America is saying, we know you communicate this way, and it's easier for you to communicate this way, and we're going to hopefully make your life easier by you sending that information. What does that say to us about, as a culture? We're becoming increasingly, and it's not just emoji. We start because this is the fun topic, but it's increasingly nonverbal. Now we're at a point where, you know, and depending on whether you call it GIF or JIF, but, you know, these are being sent out regularly. We have memes. We have all kinds of nonverbal communication, even in the form of on the Apple iOS, you can now draw little pictures and send them off. We're communicating differently. And it's going to be difficult. One issue that I've spoken on with one of my colleagues, Joe Stremek, he's over at Boxer Analytics, and they've created an e-discovery platform that actually helps lawyers to track down emoji. Because the traditional tools we have, you have to use standard text to search. So if I knew, hey, I'm in this lawsuit, I'm representing this client, and we're looking for the smoking gun, maybe there was a threat of some sort, how am I going to search for the gun emoji? I have no way of doing that. And so, you know, Joe and his team have come up with a solution that's helping folks to quell and get through that data. So these are all things that are at the forefront that you should keep in mind. And if you really want to be, you know, a tech savvy advocate, you need to know what's going on and how it's being used, because it'll make all the difference in your case.
Yeah, you're so right that it all has to do with the context and the context that's being added by these non-visual cues. You raised that Stewart case where the woman was suing for emotional distress, but at the same time blowing, sending the blowing a kiss emoji to the person that she claimed, you know, was causing her emotional distress. And the court looked at that and said, no, I'm sorry, you're not distressed if you're sending him a blown kiss. That's
right.
Those things don't go together.
Correct.
And maybe some of these other things, and I don't know if you and Professor Goldman in his article and you in editing his article got into things like GIFs or the other thing that iOS does now is we'll add, you know, the balloons or the fireworks or the pulsing laser light show as the background to your text message. So right. if you're sending balloons and saying something, that may mean something other than the pulsing laser light show, which may imply, hey, we should go hang at the club or something, you know, right. Who knows what it means.
And that's tough too, because, you know, that's a temporary feature, right? When those balloons come up, and unless you're, mm-hmm. you're in a group text sometimes where you can also like the messages and do engage with them in different ways, unless you have a non-iOS person on the chat group, you don't see, it'll sometimes say what the effect was. So how do you capture adequately, like, let's say, you know, I made an offensive comment to you, but I sent it with the balloons. Maybe that means I'm joking. I mean, really, we don't know. And so it's going to require, you know, a lot of times litigators complain about how obnoxious depositions are. And, you know, it's an onerous process in fact discovery. But now think of the degree of granularity you'll have to go into with a witness to understand their social media usage, their technology usage, how they identify certain emoji. I mean, we're going to have to, there's going to be a point where most of the evidence is going to have some nonverbal components that you're really going to have to be very, very calculated about how you build your case. And so, yeah, I am glad you bring that up. There are certain features, too, that are either temporary or hard to capture. And it may be a he said, she said. Well, he sent it with balloons, so I didn't mean it. You know, or I sent a laser light show, so clearly I was intending to party, not to be rude. You know, so what is the, where do we draw the line? And technology just keeps evolving, and it's going to require us to keep on our toes.
Right. And I suppose the other thing we should throw into the mix is all of the sort of augmented reality enhancements that things like Snapchat and now Facebook use. You know, what does it mean when I send you a video of myself saying something? Does the meaning of it change if I then have a crown of flowers or cat ears or?
Yes.
Well, and that's right. Or
I would think.
There's secondary meaning that's come with some of these filters. So I don't know if you all heard of this, but like the dog filter has become like the basic girl photo. Like it could actually be a diss. So if I were to send, you know, a Snapchat with that talking poorly about someone, maybe it's a defamation suit. I don't know what the context would be. But if I were talking to millennials, they would say, whoa, that was a burn. That was rude that they used that particular filter and then made that comment. So whereas a juror perhaps who's a baby boomer is not going to pick up on that. So we've got to, I mean, I'm serious.
I know. As a boomer, I can tell you, yes. We might not catch that.
Right. I mean, and then I have a younger brother who's 4 years younger than me, and they have things where I look at them and I feel lost, totally lost in their subculture. And so you realize that, you know, beyond just discovery, but jury selection is going to be huge in a case like this, because you want to make sure, I mean, of course, you're going to hope you pick jurors that are going to understand your version of the world. And that's always been the hope when you go through voir dire. But now you're really going to have to understand where their headspace is and what their capacity to understand these different technologies and nonverbal communications will be. And further, the question that, you know, Professor Goldman and I have talked about, are we going to have emoji experts testifying? Who are those people? You know, at what point are you classified an emoji expert or a nonverbal expert? Do we just have tech folks come in? How will we make sense of this world as we move forward?
Right. I remember when blogging and then Twitter and then Facebook all became things that not just people were using, but companies were using. There was a huge boom in the profession of social media consultant. Maybe emoji consultants are next. And Mike, you might need to hire one forthwith for Dorsey and your litigation department. What do you think?
Well, I was curious. I had previously read, Gabby, your article. I think we had communicated about it a while back. It was really interesting. Have you run into cases where courts or judges have excluded evidence of emojis just because there can be so various and sundry meanings with respect to some of these emojis that it seems potentially unduly speculative to allow it in to evidence for a particular reason?
Great question. So unfortunately, in terms of the emoji world, not yet, not that I've seen in the emoticon context from a couple years ago, there have been cases where they are let in and the litigant has complained. I mean, essentially a 403 argument, hey, this is, you know, creating a bias here, it's unfair, that they're hoping that an emoticon would have been left off of the particular textual chain because they think it was misrepresenting who they were and what they were saying. And so I haven't seen a true exclusion, and it's tough when you're doing this research and trying to get a sense of the lay of the land of emoticon law and emoji law, right? Because a lot of times these would be evidentiary things that may not necessarily be on Westlaw. You'd have to be, you know, going through some, you know, actually going through Pacer and trying to find these tiny little discovery disputes. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they exist, but I haven't seen them yet. But I think we're going to start seeing how they can truly maybe color character, or if it comes in a criminal context where, you know what, you're going to hold this evidence back because it has a potential to really impact bias here.
Interesting.
Yeah, it really is. Has there been a GIF case yet?
So there was a case that I actually don't know if it has been decided at this point, but there was a GIF that was tweeted out to a gentleman who the person who was tweeting it out knew that the person had epilepsy. And it was sent out and it had flashing lights. And they're seeing this as criminal. It was intention to inflict pain and potential death on this person who suffered from epilepsy. And so whereas, you know, you think of it as a fun little moving picture, it can be a weapon. And I mean, this case alone tells us we need to pay attention to what this means. And we haven't even dived into the, you know, the copyright implications, the intellectual property issues. I mean, this is solely on, you know, how we're interacting and how it's being used. And so I think we're going to see more of those cases potentially. There's also an argument back and forth on whether GIFs are fair use. But I think this is the emoji is the gateway into more nonverbal analyses and where we're going with the law.
What do you think, just culturally, Gabby, of the fact that we're entering this era of nonverbal communication as a society? It seems like, you know, when I think of people communicating with hieroglyphs, I'm going back several thousand years, yet we're doing it again.
Throwback Thursday. No,
yeah.
It's essentially become, it's an interesting, if you look at our development of how we communicate via technology. We went from our 140 characters, our itty-bitty amount of texting that you're charged per text, to these expansive messages, and now we're going shorthand again. We used to shorthand when we had limitations, and now we're shorthanding by choice. And you do wonder, as I think we're evolving as in a society, a lot of people claim that, you know, younger generations are hiding behind technology, they're not being as emotive. But this may be the way that folks are choosing to emote now, in ways that they couldn't before, because a Bitmoji, for example, and for those who don't know, a Bitmoji, you design a little drawing character who looks like you in a bunch of situations, and you're able to use those. I mean, I have a friend who, she said her and her husband exclusively communicate in Bitmoji. It's easier. There's less confusion. You know, it keeps them with marital bliss. But this is maybe the way that we are choosing to emote to, perhaps, as much as we it does create confusion to the outside viewer, within small communities, maybe it's creating clarity in how we communicate. I know that there are certain emojis that my friend group uses, and we know exactly what it means, or it's an inside joke, and I don't have to say a word. I send one emoji, and that's a beautiful thing. But at the same time, to the outsider, it's going to require a lot of explanation. So we're creating these subcultures, these sublanguages, and perhaps this is how we as a modern society are choosing to emote. I mean, there's even, think about just from a culture perspective, there are young folks who are afraid to use the red heart because that might signify real love. You wouldn't send that to your crush. Maybe you send the blue heart. The blue heart doesn't mean true love. Maybe it's just like, love ya. So, you know, you're coming into these intricacies that we can't even contemplate, but that every day are being formulated through trial and error and in different situations. So I think for especially communication scholars, in another life, I was an interpersonal communication major and I loved this stuff. And it's so funny, it's coming back now into my legal practice. I think there's going to be a wealth of data that they get to work with to really understand what all of this means, big picture.
Right. You already raised the case about the assault by GIF, the GIF was sent to the journalist who was epileptic and with the intention of causing a seizure. I'm wondering if you've seen anything that has been that has wound up in court. I know you've seen examples where an emoji, so something less overt. You're not trying to cause a seizure, but you are trying to badger and bully and harry. You raised before the show Rachel Roy's Instagram getting bombarded by Beyonce fans with lemons and crowns and bee emojis. So wait, have you ever... give us the context there.
So for those who don't know, so Beyonce released an album, Lemonade, last year, and there were rumors that it implied that Jay-Z had cheated on Beyonce at some point. And one of the rumors that came up was that a lady named Rachel Roy was the other woman, and that she was referred to as Becky with the good hair. Right after Lemonade dropped, Rachel Roy posted an Instagram photo with, you know, her friends, and it said, good hair, don't care. So the Beehive took that as confirmation that she was Becky with the good hair. And they proceeded to, and again, this is like a subculture, to put tons of lemons, just aggressive amount of lemons on emoji on her Instagram account. And then coupling that with the crown and the bee emoji. So Queen Bee, Lemonade, we represent our queen, essentially. And she got bombarded, actually had to turn her Instagram to private because she was overwhelmed by this response. And so people are using emoji to bully, to show affiliation. There have been, unfortunately, none that have gone to a court of law yet, but there have been instances where younger adults, you know, sometimes teenagers have posted an Instagram post or a tweet, and they have insinuated or suggested with emoji that they're going to bring a gun to school or a bomb. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten around to, you know, the school leadership, and they have taken that as a credible threat and, you know, shut down the school or brought the kid in. And so as much as we, especially younger generations, may see it as a non-issue or I'm just making a joke, you know, you get into this area where you have to ask yourself, is this a credible threat? Or is this combination of emoji? You have to ask yourself, does this actually mean, like if you did gun, bomb, winky face, does that mean that I'm kidding, I'm not going to blow up the school, or is that a credible threat? You know, you also see an issue that Eric raises in his paper is platform differentiation. So if I'm on the iOS and I look for the gun, it's a water gun now, if I have the updated version. If I'm on the Android, it looks like a pistol. So, you know, what is the intent of the sender and what are they seeing on their proprietary emoji list? And then what is the recipient?
Right.
You know, so how... Mm-hmm.
Does that pan out in that if I'm an iOS user and I'm sending someone the squirt gun, come play at the pool, let's have a good time, squirt gun. Is the Android recipient going to get the Sig Sauer instead?
Yes. So they won't see the water gun. Yeah. And I mean, even so, my favorite emoji is the dancing lady emoji with the fabulous red dress. And this one, I think, is so different. So if I were to send that dancing emoji to an Android user, it's actually a gentleman in like hip hop gear who's like busting a move, which is also super cool, but a very different context. If I said, let's go salsa dancing, and I send you that, you'd be like, what? Okay. Is it like a hip hop salsa combo? But I'm just, it's very different between platforms. And sometimes they won't even come up correctly. So let's say I did send you a viable threat. I wanted to, that was my intent. Maybe you haven't even updated your iOS and I use new emoji. So one issue is when there was a couple updates ago on iOS is the emoji, if you hadn't updated it, either came in as an alien or just a blank square. So, you know, you're going to have to go into this back and forth of, well, was the recipient really afraid for their life if they got a bunch of alien emoji when they were meant to be this particular gun or some new emoji that they didn't have yet? And it's going to be really granular because of these platform differences and also within the same platform update differences. We have new emoji coming out of Unicode all the time.
Right. Matt, my head is spinning. I might need a drink at the Game of Thrones bar. How about you?
Yes. We will wait in line and draw emojis. My question is, in terms of discovery for these type of things, when you're looking back a long time, if you're not, if specifically if you're getting a text message string that's not on an Android phone, if you're somehow able to download it, is the text that you're getting the actual emoji that the person received, or is it the code that's running on whatever platform you're actually looking at the discovery on? And therefore, are we getting the real in discovery? Are we getting the real emojis that were sent and received?
Great question. And so on the technical side, I'd have to yield to my colleague's jokes. I'm not sure how that would work, but the recommendation would be you'd probably go to both devices and do the download. And then I assume it would be TIFFed out in a way that you'd be able to see how it was originally represented for both the recipient and the sender. And then they also are able to pull, so of course, like operating system data, which was, again, makes it more difficult when you're going through evidence authenticating. You have to confirm they had updated, you know, this is the particular version. You'd have to go look back to the Unicode consortium, what had been released at that time. But, you know, they're really working to develop a way, because they're aware of this discrepancy, that you would download both the recipient and the senders, because you're going to need that to truly tell the full picture of the story at hand for the jury.
You raised an interesting point a moment ago, Gabby, that we just kind of blipped over, but it's something that's been on my mind as we have considered the issues for this show. And that's when communicating with GIFs, this whole issue of you're sharing videos that you did not create, and are there copyright fair use ramifications to that? Well, of course there are. Mm-hmm. And is there any guidance? I mean, has anyone ever sued over my video clip got turned into a GIF? That GIF is now part of what Facebook will suggest that you use when you look for GIFs about, say, falling down a hill. And people are sharing it right and left, and I have not licensed Facebook or any of its users.
It's a great question. And there is not much yet, but I think we can look to actually the rights of publicity cases that we've seen that might give us kind of a sense of where it could go. It usually becomes an issue when a company, and we always advise our clients, do not use a celebrity GIF along with you selling a product, because you think, oh, well, look, it looks like so-and-so's at the mall and this would be great. There was a case with a right of publicity issue. It was not a GIF, but it was an image of Charlize Theron walking out of a particular store, and the store decided to throw that picture up from a paparazzi website and be like, essentially insinuating, even Charlize loves our store. And you better believe she was not happy. And so, you know, in these situations, because there are so many internet, very famous GIFs that people love to use all the time with certain celebs, there might be an instance where if it's a big enough brand, hopefully they would know better, but a big enough brand that uses that GIF, you're going to have complaints from the celebrity. And if it's a very memorable part of a movie, probably a complaint from the studio and the copyright owners. So although it hasn't come up in a very big way yet, I think it's just waiting for the perfect storm where they know they've got the rights, but do you want to waste the energy? And I think it will happen the more we decide to engage with these as we are promoting ourselves and our brands, or just responding with emotion generally with what's available to us.
Right. So the right of publicity issue aside, Mike, I'm remembering back to an older Sixth Circuit case that was one of the only ones that flirted with the notion that if you used a music clip, it was a sampling case, that if you used a clip that was of a certain length or less, then you were going to be okay, possibly. I think actually the Sixth Circuit said no on that.
Correct.
Yeah.
You're right. The Sixth Circuit came out and said any sampling, regardless of how long it is copyright infringement.
Right.
The Ninth Circuit, of course, has come out the other way in a recent case involving a Madonna song that I can't recall the name of. But in that case, it was less than a second of the music that was sampled. And, you know, the court did not adopt the Bridgeport music rationale from the Sixth Circuit.
Right. So applying this to the world of GIFs, I guess the circuits are split and we don't really have a pronouncement for people. If your GIF is of a certain length or not, you're going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you could make an argument that in the sampling cases, you're talking about sampling a very small portion of the overall work, and therefore there's de minimis copying or something like that. But if you're copying the GIF, even if it's a half a second or a second, you know, you're copying the entire work itself. So the sampling rationale that was adopted, let's say, by the Ninth Circuit with respect to de minimis use or de minimis copying, I think you can make a pretty compelling argument that there's no de minimis copying when you copy the entire work.
Right.
So quickly to add, I just remembered with the GIF, there actually was a case I'm recalling now. I don't think it went very far, but there was a DMCA takedown notice issued by the NFL and I believe the Big 12 Conference. There was a particular football play that had been put up in GIF form by SB Nation, GIF, and Deadspin. And so they did claim, hey, we own the copyright here. Take this down. So if that tells us anything, of course, the big play of the game is what you want to see on ESPN or the like. That's the value. And I think that's where we're going to see those kinds of complaints pop up when it really is the heart of the work or something that is very valuable that folks would want to see and that, you know, ESPN would want to show and get money in exchange.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I haven't had enough Beyonce talk on the show yet. And I'm assuming that applies to all of you, too. So fortunately, we have a trademark application or two we can discuss. All right, Gabby, tell us what Beyonce and Jay-Z are up to at the USPTO.
Well, the Carters love their trademarks. And, you know, for those of you who follow Mr. and Mrs. Carter, they had gotten their child's name, their first child, Blue Ivy Carter. Her name was trademarked back in 2012. They attempted to trademark it. And now they've attempted to do the same for their newborn twins that were announced today, Rumi and Sir Carter. And there's a question as to whether the Carters are committing fraud on the United States Patent and Trademark Office because they have no intent to, in fact, use these names in commerce. And if you take a look at these registrations, we'll look at the Blue Ivy one as an example. This was back in January of 2012, right after Blue Ivy was born. And the Carters, through Beyonce's holding company, continually asked for an extension to show the actual intent to use in commerce, their specimen, to show proof of using the Blue Ivy Carter mark in commerce, and failed to do so. So after many years of seeking these extensions, the mark was abandoned. And now we're seeing that both Rumi and Sir Carter have been filed with the similar classes that Blue Ivy Carter was filed for. And a lot of folks are saying that the reason they did this in the first place was because there were people that, as soon as they heard the unique name Blue Ivy Carter, wanted to start selling baby merchandise with that fun, unique name with it. And the Carters felt that this was the best way to protect their child's name early on, even if they didn't intend to go ahead and create the products that they were claiming in their application. And folks were calling them out on it. And now we're seeing it in the form of an opposition to the newly refiled Blue Ivy Carter mark, where there is someone who actually has the mark Blue Ivy. And she claims that she's an event planning business. She has been using the mark in commerce since 2009. But what I think is kind of the interesting part of this is that she didn't file for the trademark until a month after Blue Ivy's birth. So she's going and claiming back all the way back and now is challenging and said, take a look at what the Carters have done. If you read the opposition on the TTAB website, look at what the Carters have done. They keep asking for the extensions. And hey, I even have this interview from Jay-Z in this magazine where he exclaims, hey, we're not going to sell products with our kids' names on it, but they deserve to be protected. And this is the way to do it. So are they committing fraud on the PTO? And, how else would you all propose that someone would protect their famous name of their famous child going forward beyond a right of publicity claim?
Yeah, this strikes me as sort of the equivalent of registering a domain name for your child, but only if you're residing in that rarefied air of the 1% of the 1%. Mike, how do you think this is going to come out?
Well, it looks very curious as to why they would file these applications from a trademark perspective. Just to give our listeners a bit of a flavor for what they've applied to register for with respect to the Sir Carter mark, they've applied. Now, this is what the baby was just recently born, right? Within the last few weeks.
Last month. Yeah.
So they've applied for in class three for fragrances, cosmetics, and skincare products. There's also a metal keychains, flags, nylon flags, towels, hair accessories, hair ties, hair scrunchies, online retail store services, playing cards, basketballs, kickballs, rubber balls, and entertainment services providing online video games. Now, that's just a very small portion of the description of the goods and services that they're trying to register Sir Carter for. So it seems very unrealistic that you're going to take the name Sir Carter, that you really have an intent to use that with respect to all of these goods and services that are listed in the application. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to be a cynic for a second, I think it what they're really trying to do here is lock up that particular name and try to stop other people from using it, kind of alluding to what Gabby was saying. And they're trying to use our trademark laws as a vehicle to do that. Of course, it's not appropriate subject matter for a trademark. You only get a trademark, or you're only supposed to file a trademark application if you have a bona fide intent to use that particular mark or service mark with respect mm-hmm. to goods or services and use those services in commerce in the course of some sort of transaction with a consumer. So, it doesn't look particularly good here, but you know, it sounds like, they've done this before and maybe had some success with it. Who knows?
Yeah, it strikes me back to the Jenners and Kardashians that some of this might be not so much we want to prevent people from using our children's names because they are our children's names, but we want to preserve their ability to capitalize on their own famous brand names when they are old enough to do so. Does that help them out at all, Gabby?
Well, again, to what the point was raised that if they're not using it now, mm-hmm. it's going to be very difficult to go ahead and get those trademark rights. And, you know, it doesn't look particularly great that there was a request for so many extensions and then a refile, mm-hmm. and then to repeat with the next two children. And I will say Beyonce has been successful in the trademark world previously. There was, an issue where folks on Etsy were selling Fiance shirts, but spelled Yonce as in the second half of Beyonce's name. And she went ahead and registered it and was able to get those products taken down. So there is mm-hmm. a value in the brand and the name, and they have obviously chosen very unique names for their children. And as much as you'd want to build a legacy for your children and give them that option, I can see where this is at least an attempt, right, to preserve that option for them later on in life. At the same time, mm-hmm. If you really want to play by the intellectual property rules and by the PTO rules, maybe it would be worthwhile to even have, they picked a lot of classes, so it's tough to release a product in all of those, from keychains to fragrances. But maybe you have a more limited scope and you go ahead and you build a website. I mean, maybe for the Beyoncés and Jay-Zs of the world, they have enough money. But for maybe smaller celebrities who would want to protect their child's name and brand, maybe you do a baby line, or you do even a shirt with a person's name on it and their, picture. And maybe that's enough to meet the specimen requirement. It'll depend on how you do it. But maybe taking a little bit more of a step than just the registration and attempting the registration when you don't have anything to back it up from a legal perspective.
Wow, you were talking earlier. Sorry, I was just going to say, you were talking earlier about is it right for a parent to post the selfie of a child that the child took themselves? I could definitely see a child down the road getting upset that you were selling T-shirts and fragrances, et cetera, with my name on them before I was even three.
The blue ivy scent, what is it? It's tough, but the question is, did Beyonce take that picture or did Blue Ivy take the selfie? We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. Mike, sorry to interrupt.
Yes. So, it's not necessarily a technical point. I think it's an important point potentially in their defense. I mean, this was filed, these applications were filed in the name of BGK Trademark Holdings. So the trademark holding company of, I'm not sure if they own this, this limited liability company together, the parents, but you could certainly imagine a situation where, if you've got a very robust marketing department and you're kind of constantly on the hunt hunt for great ideas, and you really do have an intent to use this particular mark, and you've got some things, you know, in the hopper, some ideas that have finally taken shape, and you want to make sure to protect it. I mean, that's certainly legitimate. But given, as Gabby was saying, there's so many classes here with so many descriptions of goods and services, it's rather eye-popping when you look at it here. Hard to imagine that even folks that have significant resources, you know, could have all the resources they want devoted to a marketing and brand development, that they've really have an intent to use these names on all of these goods and services.
Yes, indeed. Matt, anything to add here?
Nope. I'm taking notes on this one.
Okay. Well, just as we have not had enough Beyonce and Jay-Z in the show, or perhaps we have now, we certainly haven't had enough Kardashians in the show yet. So we're going to talk about them yet again, this time in a more criminal context. And before we get into that, just because of the alliteration of it all, our second passphrase of the show will be Kardashian crimes, so that we stay thematically consistent with our first passphrase as well. Kardashian crimes will be our second MCLE passphrase for the show. All right, so the crime in question, and it would be a crime in California under California law, is this debacle, train wreck relationship that seems to be between the is his name Robert? Matt, I defer to you. Rob Kardashian. Robert was his dad. And Blac Chyna. And the fact that in the context of accusing his significant other, mother of his child, of cheating on him, Rob seems to have posted nudes of her and other, you know, what we would refer to as revenge porn. Of her, and she in turn has retained counsel who has very aggressively pointed out that this is not okay in California and elsewhere too, but here we're dealing with California law. In fact, it's a crime that could conceivably involve 6 months in jail and various other penalties if a case were brought. So the Kardashians continue to make our headlines here at This Week in Law. And actually, the headline of this story is the one from Wired, which is, "Sorry, but you need to care about Blac Chyna and Rob Kardashian," as it goes into why this is not just tabloid fare, but a real world illustration of how California law has evolved to bar these things, and people need to be aware of that. Matt, any thoughts, since you love the Kardashians so much?
I'm just learning their names. This is so exciting. yeah, I mean, I thought that, you know, clearly the article kind of talked about how there was fear that this woman would be treated differently because of her previous occupation as a stripper. And it seems like the law is the law in that the intent of the sending of the images was revenge porn. And it seems like it should be prosecuted that way or should be if it's in California. So it just seems like not the way to break up is what I learned from the Kardashians this week. So,
right. And I've seen the attorney, I'm forgetting her name right now, but I've seen her on TV a couple of times over the last week talking about the case. She's been kind of all over TV talking about the case. And it does, if I'm recalling her statements properly, what she has said is they have not involved the police at this point, but they're certainly not ruling that out. And, you know, he's pulled everything down. And as long as he continues to be contrite and realize that this was not something he should have done, that it may just end there. That doesn't necessarily mean that the police might not involve themselves, but I think it's unlikely to happen if Blac Chyna and her lawyer don't push that. Mike, any thoughts?
Not really. I mean, if he did it, you know, it's something that I hope the authorities take very seriously. You know, we've talked about it before on the show that, you know, this is a real epidemic that is really harmful and terrible and hurtful to people. So, you know, I'm glad to see that there's a specific statute on this in California. And I think if he did it, he should be taken to task for it.
Right. What do you think about that issue, Gabby, of, you know, the it going forward, regardless of what Blac Chyna and her counsel decide to do about it? Should the police prosecute this anyway?
You know, it's definitely worth looking into it in context, in even examining his social media interaction leading up to that point. I mean, there's clearly a lot of negativity towards and anger towards what was alleged cheating by his former fiance, I think wife maybe. And so, you know, when you look even at just the strictly the code, I mean, you know, mens rea, actus reus, there is a knowing element of knowing that distribution would cause her serious emotional distress. And so I think there's enough there for the authorities to look into it and to see if that really was the intent. What I want to take a step back, though, even from the legal perspective, and just analyze what the reaction has been to this. What's problematic is because of Blac Chyna's past, a lot of folks have chimed in saying, well, no, that wouldn't have caused her emotional distress because she usually shows off her body, and which is a big problem. I think that, you know, as we're looking at some of these cases, focusing on the legal aspect, but also acknowledging that sometimes these situations bring out these societal thoughts and expectations. And just because she in her own right chose to show herself in a certain way doesn't mean that this isn't still wrong, that he took these private photos and he disseminated them in a way that she didn't consent to. And so I think we need to keep that in mind too, as we, whether it's in analyzing this case or also looking to maybe states that don't yet have a revenge porn statute or in the process of revising it, being mindful that they're drafted in a thoughtful way that wouldn't penalize people for their past behavior.
Yeah, and I'm getting probably way far afield of my expertise, but I do understand that there are these rape shield statutes that apply, maybe not in the context of revenge porn, but you know, there's certain evidentiary restrictions that are in place either by evidentiary rules or statutes that preclude introduction of someone's past sexual behavior in defense of a rape allegation or rape charge. So it seems like there would be an analogous, or should be some sort of an analogous position here that could be taken, that, you know, someone's past conduct, yes, maybe they've done something in the past that would appear to be some sort of consent, but when somebody else does it, especially a former boyfriend or spouse, you know, that's kind of a different, that could be a different animal completely.
Right. We have one other crimes and justice story to discuss before we go ahead and wrap the show. And it is the Calibri font being evidence potentially of somebody's forgery of documents that were written at the time that font was not a default Microsoft font. Can you kind of set the stage for us on this, Matt?
Yeah, so this is the second time this has actually happened with well-known countries. So this time, I believe it was from Pakistan that there was concerns that the head of the country was stealing money, which came out in the Panama Papers. And in order to cover this up, it looks like that at this point, I believe his daughter forged documents that that made it look like the money was attained legally. And unfortunately, she used the wrong font. She used a font that, although in existence at the time, was only in beta version. And so it's just highly improbable that they would have used it. It would have been Times New Roman. But this also happened in 2011 or 2012 in one of the quote-unquote coups attempts in Turkey. And Erdogan put out a document that was or a series of documents that were in fonts that weren't around at the time. It seems like if you're going to go after a massive cover up, you should check this sort of thing.
You definitely should. And this all harkens back to, I think, our emoji discussion from earlier, that fonts are a contextual communication in a way, in their own right. Do you agree, Gabby?
Yes, this is good lawyering. I just was so happy to read this article and see that they figured that out. And it goes back to our emoji conversation, back to the version control. You may be looking at, you know, text. Some people keep their text for many years. They have lots of storage on their phone. You may need to go back and understand at that time what emojis were available, which ones, and how are they being represented? Because like we had talked about with the gun emoji, it used to look like a pistol on the iOS and then recently changed to the water gun. So context is king.
Yes, absolutely. Mike, we'll have to get to Dr. Seuss next show. We're going to be on hiatus for a couple of weeks here. But the next time around, we'll tell you about the other shoe dropping in the Dr. Seuss mashup book. So stay tuned for that. But we can't end our show with so much talk about Naruto without providing you with an animal selfie of the week. This is a really good illustration of why I think courts are going to need to iron out the issue of whether these photos are in the public domain or whether someone, maybe not the animal, but someone owns the copyright to them. Again, we featured a bunch of different tools that help your animals take selfies of themselves. This is a cool one featured over at Mashable. The makers of the cloud communications company Twilio created this thing, hacked together a big red button, as they've identified it, a cigar box, an Arduino Uno, and a puppy, and trained the puppy to push the big red box, which is routed through the Arduino to a camera. And when the button is pushed, of course, the puppy got treats for pushing the button. Photo was taken and then texted to the puppy's owner. So the puppy is definitely taking photos of itself here, but the owner had to go through quite a bit to make that happen. So what do you think about this, Mike? Who has the copyright?
Well, I'm going to have to reserve judgment until we get the Ninth Circuit decision.
All right. Gabby, what's your vote?
I concur with counselor.
All right. I think the Twilio people, having gone through all this trouble, that because the law isn't going to give it to the puppy, I don't think so. I think I default to them as being able to. Well, they don't get the copyright to all of the photos that a puppy might take, not their own puppy. They don't get copyright to every single photo that might be taken by this cigar box device that other people have concocted. I don't think that would be right. But what do you think, Matt?
I think it's the same as like a dog show. Like the dog doesn't get the money for winning. and neither does like the organizer who like put the show together. I think that like the owner of the dog gets the copyright. But I'm willing to be wrong on this as well as many other things.
All right.
Matt, you raised an excellent point there that, you know, there can be copyright protection for dance routines. So, you know, if animal selfies are protectable, why can't the doggy show dance routines also be protectable?
Oh, wow. We're going down. Wow. You're making me want to.
Only if they dance to Susie in verse, Mike. That's the only way it's protectable.
or they could dance to Dead Mouse, and we'll get there in a moment. But first, I'm going to give you our tip of the week. We don't have anything to show you for our tip of the week, except for we could go to the Ninth Circuit live streaming video page, because that's where I went on Wednesday to try and watch the oral argument of the Naruto case. But I had it up and running, and here is my tip. I then realized that the case I wanted to listen to was at the bottom of the docket and it was going to take a while. So I clicked away. And when it's a high profile case, don't do that, because the Ninth Circuit's video site gets slammed. Mike, you said you managed to stay in and watch the argument. I came back and tried to watch it and found I had relinquished that right, apparently, because it was then just the constantly spinning circle and you were unable to access the video because too many people were hitting it at once. So once you get the Ninth Circuit live video streaming in a high profile case, cherish it and nurture it and don't let it go away, because it's not going to come back to you. We have a few resources of the week. First of all, let's show you the dead mouse thing. I'll give you some context to this. I stumbled on this a couple days ago and was really surprised that it is on the net, but it is. It's on the Disney site. Context further is that back in 2014, there was a trademark dispute between Disney and the DJ EDM artist DeadMau5 over his very characteristic headgear with the ears and the X'd out eyes. It's a mouse head. Disney didn't like it and was coming after him. They ultimately settled the next year. But in the course of that, while the dispute was still pending between the two of them, Disney posted this video and got to show it to you. It's still up. We're not going to show you the whole thing. But check this. So that's Ghosts and Stuff by DeadMau5 playing in the background, mashed together with various Disney cartoon footage. And while the dispute was pending, DeadMau5's lawyer sent a cease and desist and said, no, you're not authorized to use this music in your video just because you claim that my headgear is somehow infringing of you. And Disney shot back, no, we have duly licensed this music. They didn't expand on that, so I don't know what they meant by that, but I just think it's fascinating. It's still up. It's still on the Disney site. DeadMau5 apparently never pursued it. Any thoughts, Mike?
yeah, interesting. I haven't really looked at this, but I guess I don't really have many thoughts. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know how they would have licensed it without actually going through the process of licensing it, which I don't think DeadMau5 or his label think they did. That's out there and available. Should you need a Mickey Mouse DeadMau5 mashup, it is there. What else do I want to tell you? This is something that Gabby pointed to that is just phenomenal, in keeping with our discussion of emoji and things that respond to emoji. SF MoMA, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, has a, it's called Send Me SF MoMA. If you text an emoji to 572-51, with the words send me, followed by a keyword color or even an emoji, they say, they will search their database. I don't know. They have some sort of bot matching up what they receive to their vast collection of artworks, and they will send you back something that matches. So it's really fun to play around with and see what they think emoji mean based on what's in their collection and what you get back. What interesting examples have you gotten back, Gabby? I saw that you posted, you texted them the dancing girl emoji that you love, and they sent you a very, very close match of her.
Yes, it was a belly dancing photo that it was the same arm position and everything. We did coffee, and we did, I'm from Arizona, so I did the cactus and, got some desertscapes, and it's a blast. And if you need a fun pick-me-up and you want to use your emoji to do it, it's a reminder, too, of context and how everyone interprets something a little bit differently.
I did the monkey emoji in honor of our case today and got back that work of art. I forget who it's by now, but it is Michael Jackson and the monkey.
Oh, nice.
Holding the monkey, yes. So it chokes on some of them. It doesn't send you back something for each and every emoji, but it's pretty fun to play around with. And then our final resource of the week is Wired's roundup of resources, suggestions for ways to keep weighing in on net neutrality. The Net Neutrality Day of Action was this last Wednesday, and maybe hundreds, if not thousands of websites, if not tens of thousands of websites took part in alerting the public that this is an issue, and that if net neutrality is not protected, their ability to access that site or that service in the way that they have become used to and would hate to see go away may go away. So TWiT took part, as we did the last time there was an online demonstration in favor of net neutrality. The various suggestions that Wired gives you are really just not losing sight of this issue. Continue to write to the FCC, contact your representatives, let them know that this issue is important to you. Think state and local too. And I really like this one, vote with your wallet. If you have a way of supporting an ISP that is in the camp that the FCC can regulate ISPs under Title II, then do so. And they call out two of them, one in the San Francisco area and a few other areas of California called Sonic, and another one called Ting, which has access to parts of Virginia, North Carolina, and Maryland. Those ISPs have both explicitly supported the FCC's authority under Title II. And Google has done so too. So although Google Fiber is separate within Alphabet from the rest of Google, you might feel comfortable using Google Fiber for that reason too. Sonic, by the way, is a sponsor here at the TWiT Network. And then they just end with urging that people stay informed on this, fight for the future, free press, public knowledge, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, of course, and Wired will definitely end here at This Week in Law. We'll definitely continue to let you know what goes on and what the FCC ultimately does with this issue in the fall. Between now and the fall, having your voice be heard on this is very important. So please keep it in your minds and hearts. And with that, I think we're just about ready to wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It has been so fun chatting with you, Gabby. Loved all our topics today and loved getting the chance to talk through them with you.
Thanks so much. This was a blast.
Wonderful to have you. Anything going on with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry or with your firm? Anything that you want to plug that people should know about in the DC area?
Sure. So if you're in the DC area, do join the Internet Law and Policy Foundry next week. We host a massive nerd session of getting us all together to do trivia. And it's a great way to network. It's an awesome way to meet folks in the industry. And you can go to our website, Internet Law and Policy Foundry, just Google us, and you can still sign up with a team. And we have prizes, and it's a good time. So we hope to see you there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. Hey, Mike, great to see you again.
Great to be with all of you. This was a lot of fun.
It was indeed. And Matt, are you? How much longer are you in DC?
Till the end of this month. So I might join if there's not Kardashian questions.
I can't promise. I can't promise, but unlikely. You should totally come. And then we'll go to the Game of Thrones bar afterwards.
Perfect.
There you go.
Perfect.
That's
perfect.
Great.
Perfect.
Wonderful. Oh, I do like our studio emoji there.
Very nice.
I don't know.
It could have, that shows
it could have
intent,
various
right?
and sundry meanings. How do you interpret it, Victor?
I don't know. I don't know if that shows intent or.
All right. It seems evil to me. I don't know. Anyway, we're so glad that you've been able to join us for the show. We are going to take a couple of week break here for some summer fun, but we will be back in August. And when we are back, we will start recording again, as we always do, at 11 o'clock on Friday afternoons. That would be 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So please join us live if you can, but don't worry if you can't. If you go to twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows is there for you, in addition to various suggestions on how you can enjoy the shows at your leisure, on your own time, on your device of choice. So however you do listen to and watch the show, we're thrilled that you do. Do give us your feedback on the various platforms, whether it's iTunes or YouTube or whatever. We love to hear back from you with your comments on the specific shows and on the show in general. And please do reach out to us between the shows and let us know what you thought of the discussion, points you would add, guests you would suggest we have on. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. So please do email us, find us on Twitter, find the show on Facebook. We do have a page there where people are wonderful about posting stories that they think that we should be paying attention to. Same thing with Twitter. Love hearing from you guys in all ways, shapes, and forms. So please keep that coming in. And we do hope you have a wonderful rest of the month. Happy Bastille Day, everyone. And we will see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.